Elections on the national, provincial, and local levels all took place for the first time since Zimbabwe won its independence through armed struggle. The first time they were all harmonized together. They took place in March. It's important to note that prior to March, President Mugabe, ZANU-PF had entered into negotiations with MDC, the Movement for Democratic Change led by Morgan Tsvangirai, around the question of the Constitution. During those negotiations, they gave up just about everything possible because they wanted to have the elections. When they got down to the last satilia, Morgan Tsvangirai backed up and said, let's move the elections back. So he has a history of taking you through long negotiations, and in the end, depending on what his colonial masters tell him, he reneges. And I raise that to you because it's his history. The March 29th elections, people are familiar with. At those elections, the MDC won the majority in the House Assembly, which was historic in the sense that was the first time ZANU-PF had lost that. The seat spread was 99 seats went to ZANU-PF and 100 seats went to MDC. Now, it was a majority of just one. It takes two-thirds for any major legislation to go on in the parliament. But yet, it was a wake-up call for brothers and sisters in Zimbabwe, which I want people to understand. Many of the Zimbabwean people was that their attitude was they fought for independence in 1980. The only issue for them was where the land was going to come from and when it was going to come back. And so the wake-up call in the elections in March 29th put on the agenda, one, a parliament, at least the House of Assembly, which had 99 ZANU-PF, 100 MDC. The presidential election, though, which requires a 51% majority, according to their constitution, neither Morgan Tsvangirai nor President Mugabe got a majority. I think Tsvangirai got 46%, Mugabe got 43%. No clear majority. During that time, though, the MDC had raised that the elections in March 29th were not legitimate elections. Then, when they got a majority, not enough to be president, but a majority, then they said they were legitimate in terms of that. So, according to the Constitution of Zimbabwe, because there was no clear winner, they now had to be a runoff election. The December 12th movement and the Friends of Zimbabwe were fortunate enough to be there in the March 29th elections, and we're also fortunate enough to be there for the June 27th runoff elections. During the June 27th runoff elections, as many of you know, all across the United States and around the world, it was spread that people were being brutalized and killed and beat up and stuff in Zimbabwe. Let us just tell you without any hesitation that that was a lie. That in fact, even at their most extreme presentation of numbers, they said 80 people got killed during the entire election. That was their extreme numbers. And then they wanted to indicate as if those people were just MDC people. Some people did die during that election. But on both sides, they died in that sense. But in terms of elections in Africa, we don't want to talk about the 2,000 people who died in Kenya, or the number of people who were killed when Obasanjo came to power through military coup in Nigeria. Neither one of those countries having faced the sanctions Zimbabwe does. But the central point is the June 27th runoff elections was a smashing victory for ZANU-PF and the people of Zimbabwe. The idea that Morgan Tsvangirai dropped out of the election, let us go to the constitution that the Zimbabwean peoples fought for. That constitution said that once you are a candidate in a runoff election, you cannot drop off of the ballot less than 2 weeks before that election takes place. Morgan Tsvangirai waited till the last few days before the election, then declared he wasn't running. The reality is, so that you're clear, Morgan Tsvangirai's name was on every single presidential ballot across Zimbabwe. So his idea that he dropped out, the reality was it was illegal to drop out, and secondly, his name was on the ballot. So the idea he dropped out and removed himself was a lie. But once again, once it get blasted out through the Western media, they turn truth upside down and lies right side up. So We're raising that because tonight's meeting was an important meeting, because right now what has taken place is that in Zimbabwe, we have the seating of the swearing in of the new parliament. Now, the swearing in of that parliament took place today, and the official opening of parliament will take place tomorrow, President Mugabe officiating. We want you to also understand that people are aware that after the June 27th elections, through the negotiations and tenacity and courage and leadership of President Thabo Mbeki, there was a memorandum of understanding that was signed, and that memorandum of understanding pledged all three parties, MDC Tsvangirai, MDC Mutabara, and ZANU-PF, to enter in negotiations for a negotiated settlement in terms of a number of issues. One thing I want brothers and sisters here to really understand: our brothers and sisters in Zimbabwe are brilliant brothers and sisters. They are phenomenal and brilliant brothers and sisters. The West wanted Morgan Tsvangirai to go for who's going to be in charge. But what ZANU-PF and President Mbeki made sure was on the agenda was not who's going to be in charge of Zimbabwe, but what kind of Zimbabwe you're going to be in charge of. So the negotiations that took place between the three parties first had an agenda that dealt with fundamental issues, land reform. MDC had never put forward in writing a program on land reform. All they did was first oppose it, say it was the reason for the falling economy. When that didn't work, the next thing they did was they said, well, everybody was going to get down with land reform anyway. The fact that it happened, we were going to do that anyway, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. They tried to give lip service, but they had never written a program of action on land reform. So one of the first things that they did in negotiations during the Memorandum of Understanding was to sign agreements on land reform. One, that land reform is irreversible, that land in Zimbabwe is a national treasury. It belongs to the people of Zimbabwe and can never be transferred to anyone else. The other points that they raised in there dealt with the question of the resources of Zimbabwe. And people might remember that prior to the negotiations, the Zimbabwe government passed legislation that, in fact, all corporations in Zimbabwe must be the majority owned by indigenous Zimbabweans. That was historic, and that got solidified in the Memorandum of Understanding negotiations. So there were 17 points that were negotiated in the Memorandum of Understanding. They sat and went through 13 of those points. Those 13 points that they went through really laid the basis for what kind of Zimbabwe the Zimbabwean peoples wanted. Then we got to the point of who was going to be in charge of it. Morgan Tsvangirai, after all 13 agreements, suddenly gets up and leaves the negotiations. We know where he went. He came back with a new document. I think it was a proposal on the notes of the negotiations. I forgot the title. It was one of those kind of real European dry-ass titles. So you know it wasn't an African title. In that title was almost a repudiation of everything that they had already signed. But as I told you with March 29th election, this is Morgan Tsvangirai's MO. At the last minute, when they think they're gonna lose, they pull out the stops. But the difference this time was, when he came back with this document, even members of his MDC didn't even know about it. More importantly, and this is where I say the brothers and sisters in Zimbabwe are so brilliant, they said, you brought a document back, now defend it. Is your proposal? Now defend it. And what took place was historic embarrassment and exposure of the vile nature of neocolonialism. Because there's Morgan Tsvangirai with a document that he didn't write and he couldn't defend. It was embarrassing, but yet it was historic because it opened up many people's eyes who wanted to use the excuse that they were misinformed as opposed to that they were being influenced by the West. And so those negotiations went on to the SADC meeting, which just took place in South Africa. And while the SADC meeting, which is the Southern African Development Community, the 14 nations in Southern Africa, at their regional meeting, part of that meeting was set aside to talk about Zimbabwe and the Memorandum of Understanding and negotiations. President Thabo Mbeki gave a stellar, historic summary of where stuff had been to that point. Members of SADC committee in relationship to those negotiations had meetings with MDC and ZANU-PF to ask questions about what went on. And one of the brothers from Angola chaired those meetings. And one of the things that he raised was that, remember now, the elections took place in March. We're now in August. That meant the legislature hadn't sat, hadn't been seated. He raised the question that the police and the army had not been paid for months, and that that was, in fact, a threat to the national security of Zimbabwe. And it is our understanding that you left the meeting, this is the Shangri-La, and brought back a document that was not an indigenous MDC document that you could not defend. It went on from there, and then after that, you now had Nigeria come forward and tell President Mugabe that they apologize for the positions that they had taken about Zimbabwe. They were misinformed. We had Botswana, and one day, Vaughn, I'll tell you about these Negroes from Botswana. They are quite a crew from Botswana. No, for another, yeah, they're too deep. Country 3.5 times bigger than Zimbabwe, with a fifth of their population, half of which is around one major city. So it raises the question, who owns all that land in Botswana? But that's a story for another night. But they are about as reactionary as the Klan. Then there's Zambia, whose president, you know, God forgive him, he passed away. He was so reactionary, he dropped dead. But in all African tradition, you know, we pay homage to our ancestors, and they, you know, the Zimbabweans sent people to the state funeral. But the bottom line was the foreign minister from Zambia apologized to President Mugabe. The Botswana foreign minister apologized to President Mugabe. And President Kikwete of Tanzania, who is the head of the African Union, apologized to President Mugabe, because they said we didn't really understand, we were misinformed.
We were lied to.
The reality is we accept all apologies for what we knew was correct in the first place. And as Brother Ilumbe Braff said the other day to me, he says this is historic, because for all people who wavered on the question of what was happening, you know how sometimes we waver. White folks tell us some stuff enough, and then we start saying, maybe there's a kernel of truth. Maybe he really ain't a just president. Maybe he ain't a liberation fighter. Maybe he really will sell out his people. You know, white folks tell us this over and over and over and over again. They made us dislike Malcolm, some of us. You remember that? They had us walking across the street from Malcolm. But the reality is right now, we're in a much more powerful strategic position in Africa because of the tenacity and leadership of President Thabo Mbeki, and never giving up and staying the course, because you know they put tremendous pressure on Thabo Mbeki to abandon Zimbabwe. And also a tribute to the Zimbabwean people, because they did not allow them to foster in Zimbabwe what they did in Kenya, what they've done in other countries, to have Africans killing each other for neo-colonialists to be able to come back in. So that's how we really got to this point, this historic point. Today, they swore in the parliament. And now what's getting ready to ensue are negotiations. The parliament was sworn in. You'll see in the papers today that the MDC won the Speaker of the House of the Assembly. There are two assemblies in parliament. There's the Senate and the Assembly. Lovemore Moye, national something for the MDC, won the Speaker of the Assembly. But I want you to understand the nature of that vote. And I'll say this, and you all appreciate this. ZANU-PF has 99 votes. MDC has 100. MDC-C, Mutambara's party, has 10 seats. And then there's one independent seat for Jonathan Moye, a renegade ZANU-PF member. One independent seat. So, how many seats are there totally?
210.
Very good. Give that man the Zimbabwe prize over here. 210, right? Okay. The MDC won the speaker's seat by 110 votes. Now, MDC Mutabara's MDCC had a candidate that ran. ZANU-PF didn't. They didn't put somebody up. What that says to you is that the only way the MDC won was that, in fact, even some ZANU-PF members voted for him. And I want people to understand the strategy and tactics of maintaining the revolution and what's at stake. They're trying to strangle Zimbabwe economically. They went into these negotiations not that they had one iota of an inkling that Morgan Tsvangirai is ever going to run Zimbabwe. Are we clear about that?
Right.
Morgan Tsvangirai will never be in charge of Zimbabwe. So I want us to be perfectly clear about that, okay? But in the real world, where real enemies are and where people live and die, by strategy and tactics, not just ideas, the draw MDC into the government is strategic for them in terms of the sanctions, because the sanctions are an attempt to really overturn the election, overturn the revolution and institute regime change only by separating the masses from ZANU-PF. And to do that is to create such an economic crisis that people scream out for some help from anywhere. That has not happened to this point in time. And so what's taking place right now are the ongoing strategy and tactics of drawing in all the opposition so that the West can no longer legitimately in any circle signify that sanctions should continue against Zimbabwe. And that's the atmosphere is what's taking place. All of the previous memorandum of understanding negotiations have been codified and will be codified. One of the posts that was negotiated was a prime minister post. The view was to give to Morgan Tsvangirai as prime minister. You know, in Kenya, Odinga is a prime minister.
Right.
Okay? Tsvangirai is opposed to that because it doesn't have enough executive power. Somebody said this was about power sharing, not power changing. President Mugabe won the runoff election for president of Zimbabwe. And their position was that was never a question to be negotiated. The question was sharing of power. And you're not going to get no more power shared than you have earned. You're not going to get power shared by the middle of stuff you run off to the neo-colonialists to come back with what the next plan is for regime change. So the important part is, though, that SADC and some of our comrades and friends in SADC have said Parliament should be constituted. After all, in March 29th, people were elected, and that government should go forward so that the operations of the Zimbabwean government can go forward. And that on the question of prime minister, they said, we think that Morgan Tsvangirai has gotten enough power in that, more than Odinga had in Kenya, and you need to stop asking for any more. Okay? So the bottom line is we wanted to say that to y'all and answer any questions, because as the papers unfold, we just wanted to give you a backdrop to what's actually going on there, in there. The other point to make is the Senate, because there's the House with 210 seats, and then there's the Senate. And the Senate has approximately 60 seats. And then there are the traditional chiefs. The traditional chiefs are the elders of the different tribes and in Zimbabwe, and they have a position in the government as a reflection of the culture and history of Zimbabwe. ZANU-PF controls the Senate, and it controls it with 30 seats. MDC has 24, and MDT has 24, and MDC has 6, and then they're the traditional chiefs. And so that you understand, as far as the government of Zimbabwe is concerned, ZANU-PF is still in control of that government. But as far as the strategy and tactics of ending sanctions and drawing the opposition inside and then having people who are genuinely for Zimbabwe stand up for Zimbabwe, because understand, there are hundreds of thousands of people in MDC who are Zimbabweans. They're Zimbabweans. And the question of unity is a very important point, and that's what's being struggled out. But little neo-colonial apologists and traitors like Morgan Tsvangirai have to be exposed, even to their own people. And so in the questions that are coming up now that you'll see be developing, it will be a question of exposing Morgan Tsvangirai and who his real leaders are. But most importantly, it'll be consolidating Africa, because it was very important for Zimbabwe to hold to the line, to expose the question that you're not going to let the West once again turn back our revolutions in terms of that. So that's what we first wanted to say to folks. And moi. Two. Sister Viola Plummer.
Brothers, sisters, comrades, and friends, all I can add to what Omowale laid out is that we, as Africans on the continent, and Africans throughout the diaspora have won. And that there is absolutely no question about that. That Zimbabwe's leadership on an extremely crucial issue, and that was who will dictate the land politic in Africa resides with the Zimbabweans. Mugabe settled that question. Yes, it is going to reverberate in South Africa, Namibia, Kenya, and everywhere where the land is owned and controlled by neo-colonialists or colonizers, you see? So that's the crucial point. We wanted you to understand why every European in the world and some Negroes in the Congress under the leadership of Europeans, every single one of them was in lockstep behind regime change, demonizing Zimbabwe, demonizing Mugabe. The question that we wanted you to consider was why. And I think that Omowale laid it out. And if you listen to President Mugabe in his 1980 speech, what he said was that the distribution of the land was an ongoing struggle, but that that was the essence of what the struggle was going to be, and that it was not going to be immediate. It was going to be a struggle to redistribute land. So in 1980, he laid that out. In 1980, they engaged, as he said, these murderers and rapists and destroyers of humanity. They engaged them in something called reconciliation. White folks, Europeans, defined reconciliation in South Africa as they continue to own everything. That's how they defined reconciliation in South Africa. What they attempted to do was to define reconciliation in Zimbabwe in the same manner, that we Europeans continue to control the means of production, of distribution, and the ownership of land. And that's fundamentally the issue. That was the issue then. in the first Chimuranga, in the second Chimuranga, and that was the issue today. And all of the shenanigans, all of the horrendous stories in every newspaper, every day, was this demon, this dictator, this killer of his own people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, had its origin in 1898 when they went into Zimbabwe and took the land. The only point I would add to what Omawali laid out was that when they discussed a new constitution for Zimbabwe before the March 29th election, MDC Tsvangirai insisted that the presidential election must be won by 51% of the vote. That was Tsvangirai. And again, I always tell comrades to just go Google that whole struggle. Tsvangirai insisted on the 51. And the ZANU-PF and the other party at the negotiation said, fine. When he didn't get 51%, he said he won anyway. That he got 46% to Mugabe's 43, and maybe I'm off whatever percentage, and he won anyway. And if you read the New York Times, the New York Post, the Daily News, the Washington Post, the Atlanta Constitution, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, to this day, they say Tsvangirai won. The Constitution be damned. So that was, and I think that's crucial, because when he didn't get 51%, then it became he had to drop out because he couldn't campaign. And for those of us who had the opportunity to go to Zimbabwe during that election, Mugabe's posters and pictures and literature was throughout Zimbabwe. He campaigned until 3 days before the election when he went into the Dutch embassy. Tsvangirai's pictures was everywhere. MDC's pictures was everywhere. There was another person in the race, Simon Makoni. His posters and pictures. So this idea that he couldn't campaign because it was so threatening, and the fights in the street and all the rest of it was another one of those lies. So we wanted to share with you, because see, we don't have the mass media. You know, we can't combat the horrific lies that we're told, because we don't have the mechanism, we don't have the wherewithal, but we have you all. We have you all. And see, you all have to feel that you can question us about whatever you think is going on that's correct or incorrect. And I raise this because the last meeting we had here, right, I think it was upstairs or wherever, two provocateurs, one white boy and this black woman, came into the meeting and you know, pretended that they were there. Toward the end of the meeting, the woman got up and was insisting that she speak. And I was chairing. I saw her move from the back and other people raising their hands. So she insisted that she speak before some other person. And we're in December 12th. We are not conciliators. We have a program. You don't insist on anything. You follow the rules. If you don't want to follow the rules, you get up out of there and go home, but you're not going to intimidate us. We don't get down like that, okay? So she got kind of cantankerous, right? And folks say, no, well, if that's the case, no, you can't speak. And she said, I'm from Zimbabwe, and I know something, whatever. Subsequently, she and this white boy writes this stuff on the internet. Well, I tell you, they begin by talking about the New York Eight and who we were and why we were, etc. Then the woman talked about she was not allowed to speak, that she had raised her hand consistently and that I consistently ignored her and that the people who were there were applauding every time she was ignored. And I raise that, comrades, to you, to those of you who support Mugabe and ZANU and Zimbabwe, and to those of you who don't. You know, those of you who don't, but don't be traitorous, you know? Don't be insidious in your representation of Europe, because if you genuinely disunite and you genuinely take the side of Tsvangirai or Makone or the rest of them, then like men, black men and women take their point. They take their point, they make the point. This stuff about, oh, I'm scared to speak. I guess because they say we, the New York Eight, and you know the picture they had of Michelle Obama on the New Yorker? Well, that's what they continue to say I wear, but y'all could see I don't have a bandolina. And so that if you wanna disunite honestly, then that should happen. Because we make no apologies for our unequivocal support of ZANU and Zimbabwe. We did not do it in 1960. We did not do it in 1966. We did, and from 1966 to this day, we support ZANU-PF. We don't try to hide that and try to pretend that we don't. And so we need your questions. You know what I'm saying? We need you to engage. Without leaving here and go write some shit that never happened. Because in that way, all you do is continue to support Bush and Blair and Brown and Howard, if he's still in Australia, I don't know. But that's all I wanted to add so that we're prepared to take your questions.
We came to the National Black Theater because we had come here before and we had a debate inside the December 12th movement about whether having it at Sister's Place, which we own, and having it here at the National Black Theater, which we have to pay for. And that debate ended, I don't think Vi was at that meeting, that we should come to the National Black Theater because we thought it's in Harlem and it would be easier for people to get to, but we have to pay for this. So while we take people's questions, please dig deep. So that Amadi and I don't have to pay for this by ourselves. And
that's what's going to happen.
Right. And so please dig deep and make a contribution and questions. Yes, my brother.
I have a couple of questions. Since Mr. Mugabe has taken charge of that country, how has the educational system improved? And if you want to distribute land to the indigenous people, what qualifications do they have to actually run that land, to run the farms? Because in South Africa, the person worked on the farm, but the owner of the farm never gave him the wherewithal to run it after the whites left. So I'd like to know, how has the educational system improved? what qualifications do the people have to run that land? And if they have no qualifications, you give a person a parcel of land, he doesn't know what to do with it. Explain that to me.
Let me answer the one on education and why I deal with the land question, because we had an opportunity to be on some of that land. Educationally, Zimbabwe is second only to Tunisia in Africa with the highest literacy rate in Africa. Since 1980, people criticized President Mugabe around the loans from the World Bank and IMF, but one of the things that they did with that was they put it into the educational system. Zimbabwe is the most literate, 97% literacy in Zimbabwe since 1980, and second only to Tunisia in Africa. And when you start from at the time of 1980, there was one high school for Africans in Zimbabwe to now, where there are hundreds. It is a fundamental change. And in fact, the Zimbabweans who leave Zimbabwe that are in England and come to the United States are skilled Zimbabweans in terms of that. So that was one of the things that sanctions did, created a crisis, so one of their greatest resources leave in terms of that.
I mean, if you want to improve your country, why are all the, is a brain drain? Why are they leaving? There must be some reason why they're leaving.
Well, you know what? That's the national question. No, I want to answer that. That's the national question. Because you know what? Many of us left Harlem. Many of us left Harlem to go out and live on Long Island, as opposed to staying in Harlem, buying Harlem, and owning Harlem. And where even some of the numbers runners, because see, some of the educated ones who got their degrees and stuff ran where white folks gave them a job. But some of the number runners had enough sense to go buy a store, open some stuff, and do that. So I only pose that not to get away from it, but to raise, it's the national question. It's the national question. In the question of crises, in a deep crisis, you unite with what you have the most solid unity with. Most of the Zimbabweans are in Zimbabwe. According to the newspaper, you would think there's nobody living in Zimbabwe. Each year, 2 or 3 million people leave and go somewhere else. So by this time, there would be none there. That's not the truth. I'm only raising those Zimbabweans who have left are highly educated. You rarely meet a Zimbabwean who is not educated. In fact, one of my brothers here, who is from Zimbabwe, I'm not even going to point him out, is a chemist, you know, and a laboratory technician in terms of that. Zimbabweans are highly educated. So on that question, what has he done for education? More than any other country in Africa, except for Tunisia, and we don't talk about Tunisia.
I just want to get to the other part of your question is why are they leaving? And why is there this brain drain? That one of the effects of sanctions is to squeeze the economy. And so that if you are a trained doctor, if you are a trained economist, if you are a trained lawyer, there's so many of them, if you are a trained educator, and your first love is whether or not you are going to be paid money that you think you are worth. And that cannot happen given the objective economic conditions in your country. You're going to leave and chase the money. There is no, and I do want to add that all of the educated professionals left. Those who were interested in selling their skills that they had acquired in the universities in Zimbabwe took that and sold it to the highest bidder. That's the first thing. I mean, that just in terms of why they would leave. Let's talk about the land. That one of the things, and again, President Mugabe in this film talked about farmers and owners. And so that when they began to redistribute the land, They did it in three phases, right? The first phase was to move those brothers and sisters from sandy, rocky places to arable land. Small, we would call them, in my vernacular, small plots, small farms, almost subsistence farming. The second phase was to the larger or commercial lands. Did the Zimbabweans who were trained agronomists, who were trained in the, in fact, two of the brothers that began to set up how the farmers who farmed the land was really gonna make it productive was trained here in Cornell and went home. So they're there. The idea that they could not make the farms productive wasn't because they didn't have the skill. It was because when the farmers left, they destroyed the irrigation systems, they destroyed tractors, they destroyed the electrical systems and particular farms, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They also, in terms of warehousing particular seed, warehousing particular fertilizer, right, got that secured by sanctions. And how did that happen? They could not import it, neither could they use it because it didn't belong to them. So that this idea that because you farm the land, you don't know how to manage the land is a really elitist kind of concept, because every bit of education, I don't care what kind it is, comes first from the idea, then the practical application. That it cannot exist as a skill somewhere. The practical application. And in farming and planning of farms, the Zimbabweans were at the pinnacle of that. And I think that it's kind of reinterpreted when we hear it here, that Mugabe gave land to these people who didn't know anything about farming. That's why it's not productive. In fact, one of the things a couple of years ago, they said the reason why it wasn't productive was because Mugabe caused the drought, right? Mugabe caused the flood. And so those things mitigated, and they happen. Droughts, floods happen every 10 years in that part of Africa. So the idea that the land was given to people who did not have the skill to farm it is not exactly what was happening. Take your last question, brother.
With respect to, you say that the persons who owned the land prior to the land being redistributed, they destroyed the electrical systems and so forth. What is being done to repair the electrical systems? And are they employing any kind of new technology like solar, wind, so forth?
The answer, employing solar, wind, the answer to that is no. And that's the ongoing struggle to the degree that we have the expertise and knowledge and information that we have with the Zimbabwean interior ministries. Okay, because you're absolutely right. It is solar, it is wind. I mean, yes.
But I would add this though. Colette and I had a discussion with the foreign minister in Ethiopia this last year. And we sat and talked to him about solar energy. He said, One of the things that they explored that, he says, I don't want you all to think we sidestep, we dug that. One of the things about capitalism is whatever is new and upcoming, they're going to get their 6 pieces of silver. They're going to get their 10 pieces of silver. They found that it was impractical at this point because the technology is so expensive. One of the things that we think is very important about the Look East policy is because China is doing some very important innovation in cheapening the cost of putting together solar panels. That technology and the processing for that is expensive in terms of that. But they are dealing with exploring that.
But they do want assistance also. But the other thing...
But see, sorry. I agree that it's expensive, right? I agree, but it is also a political question. It is an absolute political question. What is the priority? How are we going to make sure that droughts don't totally disrupt production? I mean, it's so this is a discussion, right? I don't want to pretend that it's not going on. I don't want to pretend that we're all on the same page. But it is a discussion.
We just got to go to some other questions,
no,
brother.
I just want to say that. Back in 1993, I offered to build 2 wind turbines, one in Dar es Salaam and one by Lake Victoria for the Tanzanian government. And the money that they gave me was stolen by one of the Tanzanians and never saw the money. But the technology for building wind turbines is not that expensive. I'm not talking about the propeller stuff. In fact, I recently developed a wind turbine. You don't see anything moving. Nothing moving.
So we
don't get on with you.
I can
build you a wind turbine that can say, take care of a 2-family home. I can build you one for 150.
You can build one in St. Albans.
Brother, you need to come
before you go to Africa.
I'm sorry. Brother, but... So I hope I answered the second part of your question, and I forgot the first part. But we'll come back. Yes, brother.
I'd like to continue because I think this is the brother brought up important. A very important point.
It's absolutely.
December 12th and all you all's efforts are to be very commended, and it's clear that you've done an excellent and efficient job in maintaining a progressive political agenda for the interests of the Zimbabwean people and the interests of unity. However, will that, will part of that organizing effort include the inclusiveness, since we're included in the political aspect of it as Africans here, and in a dialogue, a expanded dialogue on economic development activity and what we can do on an economic level to ease the pressures of these sanctions? Will that effort continue, or are you open to engaging and expanding that effort?
That idea we broached in 1999, and as we move to make it a larger, you know, motion in terms of information, but more concretely in terms of participating in the economic development, the sanctions in 2002 said explicitly that you, me, or no American person, corporation, or company could invest either capital or information in the Zimbabwean economy until Bush declares there is democracy in Zimbabwe. But absolutely, and again, you know, I was talking to some comrades, and they were talking about how the Pastors for Peace, you know, really dealt with the embargo in Cuba. And just recently, the peace ships that broke the siege in Gaza. How can we, as Africans here, break those sanctions that prevents us from doing where I think that you were going? So you know, help us. Come, you know.
When we say the Friends of Zimbabwe.
Yeah, that's y'all.
December 12th, and Friends of, this is us, all of us. Economic plans, the sanction plans, all of that. But it cannot be. One of the things we discovered, when we talk about economic relationships with Africa, we have to have some principles involved with it, and we have to have some organization involved with it. And we have to have some real principal contacts for that to happen. And so when we say, I think the last thing I said when I talked about the meeting was, for people to join the Friends of Zimbabwe.
And we meet every Tuesday night, 456 Nostrinda Avenue, Brooklyn, New York. Telephone number 718-398-1766. And for those of you who want to develop some specific kinds of things and could bring yourself and people who are like-minded with you, you know what I'm saying? And we sit down and we'll introduce you or whomever to whatever we know, because this is not about us, right? This is about the liberation of some Africans who fought valiantly against imperialism.
One of the things that we did develop was we developed a thing called Z-Tours.
Yes.
Which was to take people to Zimbabwe. Not just to take people because let's go on a trip, but it was as political and cultural. But it was also a way of helping the Zimbabwean economy. It was also a way of educating people here what was going on. And so that was an idea we had, which was Z-Tours. In terms of the technology question, there are people who are open to that and the necessity of that,
right,
in terms of that. So December 12th and the Friends of Zimbabwe, we just look at as a Pan-African bridge,
right,
in terms of that. There are some other questions. Yes.
I'm not clear on why there are two representatives from MDC.
Two
representatives from MDC. MDC, the Movement for Democratic Change, had a split maybe a year ago, a year and a half ago. So one faction of the MDC went to Morgan Tsvangirai. The other faction went to Mutabare. Huh? No, what did you say?
Arthur Mutabare,
right? And so they fielded candidates as opposition parties, Mutabare's people, and MDC, they call it MDCT, meaning MDC Tsvangirai. So that's why there are two MDCs. Okay, Mas?
Oh, this is, and then the brother will do it.
Oh, sorry.
Yes, my question is, since black people on the plantation in the United States of America spend $10 million a day on hair and sneakers, how much of the $10 million a day, $700 billion a year, are we prepared to divert to Zimbabwe?
You know, that question of we is always one that you know, we can't answer. You know what I'm saying? It always, and I think, I can't remember who said it, but it always starts with me. See, and then it's me, and then that me, and then we got a we. But an amorphous we, we have no way of tapping into that. And believe me, over the 40 years that I've been struggling here, we have tried every conceivable thing that we knew to do, right? And I know during the liberation struggles, we were able to send to the liberation movement, maybe $40,000 this month and $40,000 here and boots and that. But tapping into that amount of money and that number of people, we've never had the wherewithal to do that. But again, we are Black people. And I think if we, the collective we now, here, us, because see, we can't talk about the we that's outside of here. If we are determined that that's an avenue that we must pursue, I'm a believer and an optimist that we can do that. But it always starts with the me, and then we, you know, develop into the we. Brother?
Yes, how you doing, sister? I just returned from Europe, and I just returned from Europe, and I was in London, and what I witnessed out there was they would have these daily, like, anti-Mugabe, like, pep rallies in this square. It's like near Trafalgar Square, and it seems like, I was just wondering, right, are there any other places in the Black world where they're holding these conversations like you're holding?
Actually, we found when we were at the African Union meeting in Ghana last year.
Oh, right, we should have brought
that. You know, there are young people, and I don't mean to separate young from, you know, I'm doing that trip, but across Africa, the discussion around Zimbabwe and in other parts is a heated discussion. In Europe, where you have the seat of the so-called former British Empire, they are heated because I want you to know they helped finance those things. The MDC, the Movement for Democratic Change, was financed by white financiers and bankers and investors because, understand, for them, Zimbabwe was their Cuba. That was, I mean, if you see how beautiful Zimbabwe is, that was a place that they considered to be, and you know what England's like weather-wise, this was their paradise. So these rallies that go on are funded. And like we said, there's no problem with people having legitimate differences on the question of anything that got to do with African people. The question is, in whose interests are you having them? That becomes the touchstone. Because as I said, when Shangri-La came in with the document, they said, cool, defend it. Defend it. And you see, that's the question. Because many of those rallies, they have them at the Zimbabwe embassy, is one of the other places they have them. There's a whole movement in England that's funded against Zimbabwe in terms of that. But young African brothers and sisters in Ghana, we were there last year, they had a whole big Pan-African rally for Mugabe. And I'm seeing these young brothers with different Mugabe and Zimbabwe t-shirts on and stuff. Because see, for them, their position is, what's going to happen with Africa? I mean, what's way forward for Africa? You know, if the land don't belong to us there, it don't belong to us anywhere. And so, yeah, no perfect people, no perfect presidents, no perfect countries. Mistakes, errors, like we do, go on. But we got to have some marked lines of demarcation. Zimbabwe for Zimbabweans, not for Britain. And if you got a problem in Zimbabwe with Zimbabwe, then struggle around it. But struggle around it openly and honestly and not in the interest of someone who's flown you somewhere, funded you somewhere. You know, they used to ask us, well, who pays for you to go to Zimbabwe?
See that basket, Joe? Just
yeah.
Except this time we got to pay MBT.
Yeah, but I'm saying, who pays? Out of our paychecks. Because one of the things we learn, like going to the United Nations each year, those who pay the pauper call the tune.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And you can't have self-determination and independence if you don't struggle and scratch the earth to fund yourself. Brother Roger is in Nigeria right now at a prep com to the World Conference. Right.
Yeah, we know.
And let me tell y'all,
and the sharper your politics, the clearer it is, ain't nobody gonna fund you.
Right. Wally, I just wanted to say to the brother, though, when he asked, were there rallies like this anywhere else? And I think Wally spoke to the fact that there were in Africa, definitely. You know, he mentioned Ghana, has to mention Namibia, he has to mention South Africa. And there was a poll taken by this magazine called The New African. And it was a poll taken among Africans across Africa and the diaspora, who was the most influential and revolutionary black men today. And number one was Mandela. Number two was Nkrumah. And number three was Mugabe. So that these kinds of rallies are not publicized. You see? So, but we do know of one in California, DC, Atlanta, and Maryland, right? And that's not because they were publicized or anything, just because we know people in those particular places. Yes.
Yeah, and I have a question about Tsvangirai. Which position he's going to have in that government of transition that they try to build together?
I can't hear it. I'm here.
Question was, what position was Tsvangirai supposed to have in the government?
Prime Minister.
A new position created by the amendments to the Constitution that was worked out in the Memorandum of Understanding, these negotiations, and which will be codified in the Parliament. The question became, what will the powers of the Prime Minister be? And Tsvangirai's point was, he should be the executive of Zimbabwe. And we understand that if he became president, he would reverse all of, in fact, by racism, one of the MDC's plans for getting the Zimbabwean economy back, they were bringing in German economists to revamp the whole Federal Reserve Bank in Zimbabwe.
But I'm lying. I think that we should be really straight up and direct. The war veterans, the war collaborators, the families, the military apparatus, the police apparatus, made up of brothers and sisters who died, whose families died, whose comrades died for the liberation of Zimbabwe, will never allow Tsvangirai, who deserted, who was a traitor, and who to this day serves the interests of the former colonizers. So I don't want to suggest to you that there is this, what can I call it, that there is this reconciliation to the point where Zimbabwe will be turned over to Morgan Tsvangirai. Okay, so, you know, I want to be clear that that's not what we are saying. What those 4 points, those 17 points enumerated, was a unity, a sharing of power, not regime change and turning power over.
Yes, so a question, but in terms of, I mean, I know that that's happened with a lot of pressure from Western country. Now, our perception is a kind of failure for Africans to stand about themselves, or as you say, is a kind of strategy to, you know, to try to bring those together and maybe waive sanctions. But how are we going to see it? You know, because it was a lot of pressure, just like in Kenya, even though Mugabe still have power, but to have Shangri La like the head of the prime minister will always be very.
It will be,
I think Vi's point was, it will be contradictory, but it's something that they will manage because the power in Zimbabwe will remain in the hands of those people who fought for Zimbabwe. And so these negotiations are going on right now are real negotiations and strategy and tactics. But believe me, the army and the military force of Zimbabwe and the generals who fought for liberation in Zimbabwe have no intentions of allowing anything to reverse what people gave up their lives for in Zimbabwe. And the lessons of other countries is so instrumental to them in terms of that. That's why I'm saying in Mbeki, this recent, you know, holding of the line until people could no longer deny what they see and the lies that were being told to them is very important. You know what Mugabe said at the end of the UN? Leave us alone. See, leave us alone. Africans will solve Africans' problems. And if you stay out of our business, we will, as we did for thousands of years before that, try to resolve differences and stuff we have. Which is why even I said with MDC, there are people in MDC who are genuine Zimbabweans. They have differences. But those differences cannot be at the expense of bringing down the nation in that sense. Yes.
Good evening. Who are Zimbabwe's friends on the international scene? And are they helping them to fight off this embargo against a country? And I think many of us should remember, look back in time and remember what was done to Jamaica. When Michael Manley tried to bring off some of the greatest social changes in Jamaica, and what the Western powers did in destroying Michael Manley and turning back the revolution in Jamaica.
The frontline states in Zimbabwe, in Southern Africa, support Zimbabwe. Namibia, and under the leadership, former leadership of President Sam Nujoma, are solidly in support of Zimbabwe. And in fact, when Zimbabwe was having these machinations about military stuff, the Minister of Defense from Namibia came to Zimbabwe to say, you know, let's be clear. And that's what his trip was, to say, oh, if it's going to go down like that, then let us show what's going to go down. Cuba supports Zimbabwe. China supports Zimbabwe. And to those folks who hear this question around, China's doing the same thing that the white folks was doing, blah, blah, blah. Let's be clear. China has no colonies, and the negotiations that are going on give Africa an alternative in terms of resources. And that struggle for that development will go on. Angola, you know,
Mozambique,
kinda, yeah. And just in terms of South Africa, I just wanna be clear about this, because people hear what COSATO's doing and the trade union stuff. The masses of people in South Africa solidly support President Mugabe and Zimbabwe. And whenever he goes to South Africa, masses of South Africans come out in support of him because they know if we don't support Mugabe, then we're never getting our land back. Because the land question in South Africa is 1,000 times deeper than it was in Zimbabwe. 1,000 times deeper. And white folks are doing better in South Africa now than they ever did. They have some very serious questions to get down with there. But the unity of SADC, and that's very important, the unity of SADC is stronger now because of the exposure of the role of the West and Morgan Tsvangirai's, you know, deceptions and lies in terms of that. And so...
And you know, I would just add that to the brother's point, about the never, ever yielding of the demand for empire by the United States, by Europe, that in fact it must be our task to make sure that we never lose sight of that. Small victories, small defeats, big victories, big defeats, that they never stop. And sometimes we do, which is why we say to the brothers and sisters here to join the Friends of Zimbabwe, right? To make sure that we're on point with all the machinations that the West is engaged in and how they're doing it, right? How is it that they plan to encircle? You know, who is the president of Liberia? What of a military command, an African command? What is that? What's happening in Sierra Leone that you make sure that doesn't hit the newspapers, that what hits the newspapers is Mugabe, ZANU-PF, the killings, the da-da-da-da-da, right? But the encirclement,
you remember right? The G8 meeting, remember at the G8 meeting in Japan? Yes. Yeah. All of the issues that had to do with poverty and stuff in Africa, they spent 3 hours discussing Zimbabwe. Mm-hmm. 3 hours they spent discussing Zimbabwe in opposition to all of the other misery and exploitation they're bringing in Africa. They wanted to spend their time with Zimbabwe. Why? Because they understand what the symbol of Zimbabwe means. It's a direction. All the liberation movements that fought for the principles of self-determination that got sidetracked, Zimbabwe is like the engine trying to put the rest of the train back on the tracks. And they know once the train gets back on the track and everybody heading in the same direction, then there'll be contradictions, but they will certainly struggle to get their resources back.
But we in the West, okay, because I think that's what, I mean, wasn't the essence of what happened to Manley, but in fact, there was not the kind of concerted struggle by Africans in the diaspora to support Manley. Okay, that we, you know, we become provincial and territorial and super intellectuals, you know, and we become all of that except Africans concerned with the liberation of Africa and Africans throughout the diaspora. So, yes, Africa is getting stronger. Yes, SADC. Yes, all of the combinations, economic and political combinations on the continent, but we are in the belly of the beast. And the degree to which we are absolutely certain that we are in the belly of the beast and what our responsibilities are here, right? Is the degree to which we at least mitigate the kind of thing that happened to Manley. That question.
Can you give details on what happened to the payments that the British and American governments were supposed to make to the white farmers in Zimbabwe and what happened to that money? And the second part of the question is, can you explain how cash crops contribute to the debt of African nations and lead to the starvation of the African people?
First part of the question, yes. Second part, we have to talk about the nature of cash crops and on what particular market and on what particular area, right? Because if we, that's the second question. But what happened to the money? Very interesting. Europe and the United States reneged on the money. They claimed to have paid, they reported that there was between, and I'll get the exact figure for you because I don't have it at my fingertips, but they claimed they paid between $30 and $50 million to repatriate some of the farmers who owned the land and was going to get the money and move back. What happened with that money, the administration up, and not the administration by the Zimbabweans that got reported, okay? The administration of that money, by the time it got to the farmers, paid for tractors and water and inputs. But never did they give the money to the Zimbabwean government to buy, to pay those farmers for the land that they stole. So I know I read some time ago where they gave all this money to the Zimbabwean government and the Zimbabwean government stole the money. Well, I tell you what, if that had been the case, it would not have been whispered. It would have been plastered everywhere all the time as one of the charges the Zimbabweans continued to raise. You reneged on the 1980 Lancaster Agreement about paying farmers, willing buyer, willing seller, for their land, because the Zimbabweans took the position, we will not pay thieves who stole our land. And then the Zimbabwean people buy back the land they stole. The Americans reneged. When Tony Blair replaced Thatcher, his position was that was her agreement and not mine. And again, if you write to the New African for, you know, really explicit detail, because right at on my fingertips, I don't have them. But generally, they didn't pay. They didn't pay for the land. See, when we talk cash crops, in Zimbabwe, we talk cash crops of tobacco.
Cash crops, there's cocoa. There's soybeans. People cannot eat that stuff.
Let me just get a location. Are you talking about the cash crops in Zimbabwe or cash crops in all of Africa?
First Zimbabwe and the rest of Africa.
No, can't deal with the rest of Africa. Okay, let's try to deal with the cash crops in Zimbabwe. Understand that the cash crops in Zimbabwe is tobacco, is beef. There's three. Yes. Horticulture.
Carnations.
Flowers.
Right. Carnation.
Yeah, horticulture. There'd be carnations and roses and orchids, right? Those farms are owned by European commercial farmers. They take those crops to the international market and sell them for profit, most of which goes back to Europe, because remember, until 1999 or 2000, I can't remember, crackers had dual citizenship. They had citizenship in Europe, England, and citizenship in Zimbabwe. So they paid taxes and had accounts in Europe. So they owned those cash crops. How you organize your economy, and this brings back just a discussion I had for years and years with my son about Cuba. How you organize your economy, right, it sets what your emphasis will be. Will it be on crops that will bring you the necessary foreign capital that you need immediately before anything else that you need in order to develop other sectors of your economy? You see? My son takes the position that the emphasis should have been on developing the means of production as opposed to concentrating on a cash crop to get capital to develop the means of production. And therein lies the contradiction, right? Chicken or the egg. But that was that. One, two, and we're done, right?
We're done.
Yes.
Media. Well, very quick question. Is this going to be on MySpace? Because, and I want to follow up with another question. Are we overestimating the power of mainstream media and underestimating the power of alternative forms of media like MySpace, WBAI, and various others in terms of getting the truth out?
I don't think we're overestimating the enemy's media. It is very focused, it is concentrated, it is repetitive, and it is almost totally pervasive. Even when you hit Google, they can arrange on Google what comes up. I remember you can almost say the devil and Mugabe's name would come up.
So,
no, I'm just saying, to your first thing was, are we overestimating? I don't think we're overestimating. It's extremely dangerous. Underestimating, well, that's the struggle that we're in.
I don't know if it's underestimating or
underutilizing.
And that there are so many of us, like me, who definitely not only underutilize it, but have a almost paranoid kind of relationship to it. Years and years and years ago, when they were developing the internet, and the FBI and CIA said that you will not develop a chip that we would not be able to plug into at whatever level of development. So when I heard that, right, and this is really backwards, nonetheless, you know, I definitely, as a matter of,
let's say principle.
underutilize it. However, having said that, I know my comrades to the degree that's humanly possible support maximum utilization of it, definitely, and would accept, I'm sure.
Yes.
You know, see, that's
why,
what.
Do you do that?
Is that we again?
Do you do that?
No, I know people that do that.
Okay,
well then bring them on Tuesday. Bring them on Tuesday because we have some footage of some of the farms. We have some footage, stuff that we don't think will compromise anything, but just information. And, you know, we had a program the other day to show the rallies in Zimbabwe because some people come from that, just ignorance by the mass media that Mugabe's holed up in some kind of big hacienda with machine guns out and the masses are storming the barricades. So I know we showed this picture of this massacre of 70,000 people, you know, in unison at just a mass opening, a rally, and people said, wow, that was real. So yes, bring them on Tuesday. Bring them on Tuesday. If not this tomorrow, bring them next Tuesday.
Mike, I said this sister, and then I said they were gonna be the last two, but I know you too long, so you got to be the last word.
Okay.
I was wondering if you know the position of the presidential and vice presidential candidates' positions on the sanctions of Zimbabwe. And the other part is that I was wondering if your organization is constantly bombarding the government with our position on Zimbabwe?
Absolutely, on the second one. The first question was?
Presidential and Vice President. President, Vice President.
President Barack Obama is black, period, end. Let's don't talk about nothing else. Catch my drift?
Yes.
Okay. Biden, you know who Biden is. But President Barack Obama is black. And for all of y'all who say that ain't enough, he got a bop, 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 it is enough. Period, end. It is enough. Period. That's the end of that. Mike, love you, sis.
I'm gonna be brief. Y'all are late with your latest electronic update on what's happening in Zimbabwe, okay? The pieces that you have done have been invaluable in us trying to educate our families, our friends, who have been bombarded by the media, okay? And slowly and steadily, people are beginning to see the light.
Yes. Right.
Keep them going, keep them current, and you know, we'll do the rest.
Thank you. Straight ahead. Mugabe is right! Mugabe is right!
Mugabe is right!
Mugabe is right!
Mugabe is right!
Mugabe is right! Fight on, Mugabe! Fight on, Harlem!
Fight on, Harlem!
From Harlem
to Harare.
Where's the fight gonna be?
In the street!
Straight ahead. We collected $246. We like to round it off to $300. There's a box on the end. If you can make us a little more, straight ahead.
Oh, you know what we didn't say? President Mugabe in September is coming back to Harlem. So check this out. We're gonna have to defy a lot of stuff. And I hope y'all sign that mailing list, right? Because Crackers is going to be pulling a whole bunch of stuff, right, to not have that happen. But he's coming. We're going to bring him back to Harlem. And we're going to need your help because we need to turn out. The last time he was here,
4,000.
It was 4,000. I know the brother told me the other day, listen, don't worry about not meeting that number. I said, what you talking about? When he comes this time, we're going to do 8, right?
Yes.
Hey, up.
Yes.
We're going to do 8?
Yes.
We're going to do 8?
Yes.
We're going to do 8?
Yes.
All right, I got your pictures. I know where you live. So we coming for you to help us do this. Thank you.